Its psychological causes have to be assigned greater importance, and its connection with man's slaughter of animals has to be studied by the light of the law of recompense. It was said in the Wisdom of the Overself that the most excessive form of the animalistic evil in humanity is being brought like scum to the surface during the present epoch in order to remove it more easily. All the selfish killing tendencies, the violence and greed, the hate and spite, the anger and suspicion, the resentment and revenge which have had their worst manifestations in the two world wars, find in the tremendous explosive force of atomic bombs their final expression. Beyond such murderous violence, mankind cannot farther descend. Humanity's blind adherence to its animalistic fighting and killing propensities manifests itself in two terrible deeds of the taking of men's lives in war and the taking of animals' lives in peace. The former could hitherto be justified ethically by the excuse of a righteous cause and enforced self-defense. The latter could hitherto be justified by the excuses of dietetic ignorance, inherited needs and social habits. But the former is sometimes avoidable and the latter is often unnecessary. We need not ignore the evil in our fellow men, for we have to deal with them in a practical world, neither should we ignore the soul working silently within them. The evil will go eventually, the good will remain permanently. If we have to enter into relation with them, we must perceive what is wrong in them, but we should do so impersonally without ill feeling. The human weakness which returns one wrong for another, which seeks to retaliate or to revenge itself against the wrongdoer, is unacceptable. We must do what social responsibility calls upon us to do in such a case. But we should not sully ourselves with lower deeds. Nor should we ever indulge in the useless but common habit of condemning those who have committed offenses against us. Jesus has explained one reason for this counsel: Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And Epictetus has pointed out how the man who cultivates his power of looking beneath appearances will not find fault with others. Their evil conduct arises out of the imperfections and limitations in their psyche, out of its unbalanced or undeveloped condition. They cannot help doing what they do because they cannot help being what they are. And this in turn is the inheritance of all their past experience, all their past thought. Time will teach them, life will instruct them, suffering will drive the poison out of their system. The law of recompense will take them in hand and discipline them. When they become acutely aware of the mischief wrought to other lives and the harm wrought in their own, they become truly penitent and more discerning. This requires much time and many births. Meanwhile, we humans may learn to forgive what life itself may sometimes forgive. There would be little hope for humanity's eventual escape from the thraldom of evil, if God's grace did not enter into its evolutionary life at some point or through some blessed man. And this does happen, bringing redemption, liberation and illumination. There is love at the heart of things. There is forgiveness for repentant man. There is forgetfulness for his forsworn sins, but only to the extent that their causes within his character are removed. The merciful remission of sins, the compassionate granting of pardon, is a fact in the relations between human beings themselves. How much more should it be a fact in their Divine Father's relations with them? Forgiveness of sins is a fact, not merely a hope, but it is a fact only for those who learn and apply the lessons of their sufferings. The others must bear the consequences of their wrong conduct, otherwise karma, the law of recompense, would be an erratic and unreliable law, and the experience it brings would be valueless. This is because it does not become operative until after the repentance of sins and the actuality of reform. The belief that he too, depraved sinner though he has been, may also expect forgiveness and attain to goodness, is a true one even for the worst of men, if only he becomes deeply repentant and changes ignorant living habits, character and conduct. The law of recompense, karma, is not a vindictive one. It does not, as some believe, express the Hebraic eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. If it did, there would be no hope that humanity could expiate its dark karma or escape from the tangled web which it wove around itself in the past. The actuality is that as soon as it comes to the full understanding and deep conviction that wrongdoing must be abandoned, and as soon as its character, conscience, intelligence and balance are sufficiently developed, it frees itself from the consequences of its mistaken past. In other words, by changing itself, its mentality and its feelings, it creates a new and powerful cause, while the law itself produces the new effect of that cause, which is to bring an end to the dark karma inherited from its ignorant past. In this sense, there is a forgiveness of its sins, which is a different sense from the merely sentimental form of wishful thinking that, in religious circles, misuses the idea of forgiveness. The past cannot be totally wiped out, even when its legacy can be modified. With the aspirant, forgiveness applies only to a specific sin or a specific group of sins. With the adept, it applies to the totality of all his sins. For the first is still carrying his unfulfilled self-earned recompense entwined round his neck, because he is still carrying his ego. But the second is liberated from the burden because he is liberated from its hidden core, the ego. In dealing with those people who have fallen victims to the suggestion of malevolent forces, whether continuously or intermittently, we must remember not to condemn, resent or hate. We all carry a load of wrongdoing out of the far past, yet we are always ready to seek forgiveness of this heavy recompense. If we are not ourselves prepared to forgive those who wrong us, we have no right to expect the remission of our own sins. This, in fact, is a spiritual law. All those who seek forgiveness for themselves should follow the rule of forgiveness in their dealing with others. Every time they have to endure hatred from men, they are given the chance to learn goodwill towards men. Where others find only poison, they are to find its antidote. But these are not the only grounds for such an attitude. There is another, and one not less solid. Each man's thought contributes its little mite to the world's store, makes it better or worse. He is responsible for his own thoughts, and if he is on the spiritual path, he must try to keep them constructive, positive and harmonious, not destructive, negative and discordant. Darkness has no positive existence in itself. It is simply the lack of light. Just so, ignorance is simply the lack of knowledge and evil is simply the lack of good. And just as the only way to get rid of darkness is to bring a light into it, whether by switching on the lamp or opening a window, so the only way to remove evil from the world's thinking and eliminate the ignorance that promotes it, is to bring more good thought and spread more spiritual knowledge in the world. As man unfolds his diviner characteristics, he sheds his grosser ones. By his own labors in self-improvement, he prepares the way for the entry of God's redemptive grace. When he discovers his real self, whose first attributes are love and wisdom, he discards evil and error. In the moment that he casts aside the shrouds of ignorance, he sees through the evil values and turns to the good ones. To know himself fully, he will have to know himself as a ray of the divine sun, shedding light and expressing goodness. To understand evil fully, he will have to love the pure truth rather than pleasant illusions. And then that same evil which was formerly a dark and tragic riddle to his lower perceptions, vanishes as such before his higher ones and becomes transmuted. This quiet confidence in the ultimate goodness of the universe is based on a finer perception and is not to be mistaken for the unbalanced optimism that is based on a boisterous emotionalism. Man is himself led to reflect it through spiritual guidance by revelation from without and by intuition from within. This helps his evolution towards it but does not guarantee it. For that look to one fact alone is the presence in every heart of the over-self, whose patience will outlast 1,000 reincarnations of denial, whose power will master all animal impulses and calculating worldliness in the end, whose magnetism will draw him irresistibly through countless pains and raptures, for it is love itself. There is an idea implicit in the very orderliness of the cosmos. Science has begun to get some dim glimpses of little fragments of this plan. The last value of science is its revelation of the presence of law in the cosmos, for law presupposes mind and infers intelligence. Even so far as man's present knowledge of the laws of nature extends, some kind of unifying mind is evidenced behind them. That it is not indifferent to his development is also evidenced. Nothing and no one has ever been, could ever be, outside the infinite being's infinite field of awareness. Moreover, no event could ever happen except within its infinite field of law. If all men knew how much perfect wisdom, intelligence and orderliness have gone into the cosmos, all would fall on their knees every day in deepest reverence before the power behind it. Let us derive from every intuited fact the firm assurance that a divine law holds all the processes of the universe in its power, and a divine mind exists behind all the innumerable human minds and is their source and goal. If anyone sees only a universe governed by blind chance, that is only because his own eyes are myopic. It was Remy de Gourmont, a distinguished French literary critic, who wrote, "Truth is an illusion, and illusion is truth. Humanity has never lived except in error, and besides there is no truth, since the world is in perpetual change. If you succeed in building up a true image of the world, it will cease to be true to your grandchildren." If de Gourmont had addressed his words to those metaphysicians who acknowledge no higher guide than what the intellect can ascertain, they would have been correct enough. But his over-analytical mind inevitably missed the one fact that defies all analysis, the fact that there is a hidden reality which manifests its existence you, although not its natura through the world's appearance, and an eternal law which governs these endless changes. We learn from philosophy that the life of the whole universe, no less than the life of every man, is ruled by order and not by accident, by law and not by chance, by intelligence and not by senselessness. There is an intelligent direction behind every phenomenon of life and nature in this cosmos. There is no event, no creature, nothing in the whole universe which is without significance. This is so and must be so because the whole universe is the thought of infinite mind. Everywhere and always the universal intelligence is ever present, unceasingly working. Nature's laws are really its laws. And this still holds true even where man's limited power of sight sees fault because of the presence of evil and death. The chaos and confusion, accident and chance, the pain and misery in human existence are only passing appearance, not durable reality. Even where we cannot know or see, as is mostly the case, we may believe with confidence that a higher power is activating the world process for what will ultimately prove to be the best interests of all creatures and things within it. To the persevering student of philosophy, all the pieces of this mosaic pattern, which individually seem so meaningless and unrelated, gradually fall into place and reveal the wonderful significance of the whole. There is wisdom and goodness at the heart of things, and we may walk with faith even when sight is denied us. The divine idea is the outcome of divine wisdom and perfect understanding. Therefore it is the best possible one. And it could not have been other than it is without the divine mind being other than it is. The universe too cannot be other than the best possible one. If we fail to perceive this, we fail because finite mentality cannot comprehend infinite existence. If, in this matter, we begin by doubting the wisdom of God, we shall have to end by accepting it. Such conscious acceptance of the divine order of things does not come easily to most men. Indeed, it comes only long after their reason has first complained and their emotion has first rebelled against it. The ego must first be laved with grace before it will submit and accept. Even in its spiritual aspiration, it is forever looking for quick results, the higher self, for durable ones. Hence, the eternal patience with which that self gazes down on its offspring's sufferings and waits for its reclamation. Many may deplore this awe-inspiring patience. Yet in no other way can it really promote and guarantee the genuineness of the ego's evolution. For every upward step the latter takes will then be a spontaneous one, elicited from within itself by its own experience and observation. Its growth will not be artificial and dubious but natural and sure. The ego has the right and freedom to make its own mistakes and involve itself in consequential suffering, because it must become thoroughly integrated with its parent self by a process as natural as the seed becomes a tree. It is not for weaklings or cowards to take such an impersonal view of the universe, to see its idea as wise and its processes as good. A man must call up the hero within himself to be able to do this. The heroic attitude is indeed the price he has to pay for truth, that truth which brings peace in its train. He who takes such a long-range view, he who formulates such a large-based conception of existence, will never yield to despair over mankind's present misery or contemporary darkness, chaotic unrest and seething tumult. He knows that holy forces will interpose themselves more and more into their history, despite all temporary lapses or partial retrogressions. For everything and everyone dwells inescapably within the principle of beneficent being. Bitter and brutal experiences will not be glossed over, for he may not try to shut his eyes to the evil forces and chaotic morality, to the tragedy and degeneration in the world around him. Indeed, he will see them even more clearly and more alertly for what they are than other men, because he will see down to their very roots in human nature. He will never pretend with the softer idealists that they are not there. Yet the consciousness of these harsh realities can never intimidate him or disillusion him. He knows that they will one day arouse more men to seek for the only power by which they may be overcome, and meanwhile, until they are so wakened, he himself must hold aloft his own guttering candle of inward light. This is his responsibility and he will not retreat from it. This is what he can do for humanity and he will certainly do it. The ugly side of life need not be ignored, as some mystics and yogis in the East and certain cults in the West ignore it. Such evasion of their existence is either a moral cowardice or an emotional narcotic or an intellectual befuddlement. Philosophy faces this side, with all its evils and horrors, and does not deny it, but neither does it accept it. Let those who wish serve humanity by the means within their power, let those who can seek to distribute the spiritual waters of life and the material bread of man, but, this said, let none of them fall into gross error of believing that the laws of the universe are all wrong, that the powers of evil are almighty and that unless they personally interfere with the course of events the outcome will be most deplorable. This is not so. The universe will still carry on, whatever they do. Its administration is still in capable and beneficent hands. God is still the supreme authority and does not require or ask anyone's help. The vague feeling that, despite all the suffering and sin, the outcome of this drama of the human race will, in the end, be a blessed and happy one is correct. Where today we see evil in a man, an event or a place, it is rather the absence of good, just as cold is the absence of heat. For the good rightfully belongs to the inner nature of things, and can never permanently vanish. The surest guarantee that good is always destined to triumph, however deferred the hour of that triumph may seem to us, is to be found among the attributes of the power which sustains all existence. One of these attributes, as sensed by all mystics who have approached the divine, is love. To know, to feel or believe this, is to know, feel or believe immovably in the ultimate rightness and beneficence of things. The philosophical mystic affirms that hatred is not a permanent reality but only the temporary absence of love, and just as darkness vanishes when light appears, so will these negative emotions vanish when evolution forces men to waken and admit the love which is inherent in their deeper self, the over-self. The philosophic conception of life sees in the presence of a divine soul in man the further guarantee that his feeling nature will one day experience such true happiness, that his intelligence will know and understand it, and that his character will finally evolve into a state of truth, goodness and beauty. That is why it is exempt from the melancholy experience of H.G. Wells, who had to replace in old age his earlier tremendous scientific optimism about humanity's future by an equally tremendous scientific pessimism. Earthly experience is not an instrument of human torment but a device for human education. Its lower values are transmuted by time into higher ones, its evil values into good ones. The immense multitude of human beings which has passed in procession over the face of this turning globe for unknown millions of years, has not passed in vain. The mysterious laws of this cosmos will not and cannot allow an ultimate triumph of forces or entities which violate their inward essential beneficence. If the appearance of individual evil is an ordained phase of human development, the liquidation of individual evil is equally ordained to succeed it. This is the paradox, that although evil is present everywhere, it will prevail nowhere. Analysis of what it is shows it to be a set of values and qualities, not an eternal principle. That a cosmos divinely born and divinely sustained should illogically contain such evil qualities, is something not to be understood at first thought or judged at first glance. Instead of seeking their origin in the universe without, we ought to seek their origin in our own consciousness within. For they represent a corruption of human values, an alienation from the higher self and a misdirection of free will. The evil man writes in water, the evil being is a track in the sand. For the destiny of the one is to be transformed, and of the other to be forgotten. Somewhere in the exercise of human free choice, a cycle of sinful thought, feeling and action came into being. But as it had a beginning, so shall it have an ending. Since it starts afresh in each individual, it ends there, not in the species. The sinful kingdom of hell is within us. The sinless kingdom of heaven must therefore be found by each for himself, and it must be found within himself. That sinners may one day become saints, that the evil life may one day be transmuted into the good, is not only a possibility we must admit but also a truth we must recognize. If the present situation of humanity depresses us and if the prospect of its future situation frightens us, still we must not desert our belief in the eventual triumph of right over wrong and in the eventual destruction of the forces of destruction. We are not merely to believe this because we wish it to be so but because it is so. We must never forget that the advances and victories of the dark powers are only illusory, they seem to be real but they are not real. If there is evil in the universe, nevertheless the universe itself is good. If ordinary men have to look to the far-off future for the transformation of the darkness of the one into the light of the other, the sage finds the light here and now. He sees the menace and danger of the times for what it is, but he knows that he will be as secure later as he is now, because he, the true self, cannot be touched, cannot be reached by any menace or any danger, but dwells beyond them. The universe which he sees is ever shining. His higher consciousness has put such a different aspect upon it that he is reconciled to it as it is today, and not only as it will be one day. He knows well enough that if so many of the creatures within the universe have to pass through an evil phase, the Supreme Being behind the universe never does, insofar as he has brought his own mind into harmony and unity with good, he perceives how it will forever be more than evil. Thus in the end every man will have to solve the baffling problem of evil for himself. Nobody else can solve it for him, for he must penetrate to the very depths of his own consciousness, those mystical depths where the over-self resides, before he can possess himself of its true solution. The true philosopher is conscious of one fact, taught him perennially by his over-self, that truth will triumph in the end, that good will outlast evil, that tolerance and kindness will overcome persecuting cruelty and that the spiritual tendencies will outlive and outweary the materialistic ones. If the realization of these things is not for his time, if they are hidden in futurity, he learns to acquire nature's patience. If the earlier development of the human entity seems to necessitate the bringing of evil to the surface of his life, the further development equally necessitates the banishing of this evil from his life. Even within the next 2 or 3 millenniums, civilization will shed so many of its evil characteristics, including wars, and acquire so many finer ones, that it will be blessed by a veritable new and joyous epoch in comparison with its present state. Just as the dinosaurs and other reptilian monsters died out when the planetary conditions had nothing further to express in that way, so the tiger and the vulture will die out at the same time outside man as nature and inside him as passion and greed. Just as every night is followed by a dawn, so the dark period of materialism which now is culminating with its worst features, will be followed, first by a short transition, then by a dawn period when the bright rays of a better age for man will manifest themselves. Chapter 9. God is. What can be written in these pages possesses its own importance, but what must perforce be left unwritten, is of even greater importance. Since so many of the foregoing statements depend on the single affirmation of God's existence, and would fall down with the unreality of that existence, it becomes needful to speak a few words on behalf of the speechless. If, as Bacon says, anyone merely scratches the surface of philosophy, he may become an atheist. But if he digs a deep shaft into it, he will become completely convinced of God's existence. Since a crystal, a flower, and a human body all follow the same law of development by stages, and since these stages and their forms show an intelligence behind them infinitely beyond that of man's, he who denies its existence is emotionally prejudiced rather than intellectually penetrative. If he could consider without such prejudice and deeply enough the nature and usefulness of the four seasons, the creative power of the sun and the travels of the planets, he would have to add law to this intelligent rulership of the universe. There is no chance in all these things. If anyone considers all the evidence of intention of life here and on the stars out there, and fails to come to the belief that a higher power directs all, if he comes only to atheism, it is because the mind with which he considers this evidence is already closed by bias or ill-balanced by emotion or upset by suffering or too extroverted by the body's senses or faulty in some other way. The world is not bereft, like a corpse, of life and sense. It has both. There is within and behind every bit of it, even when undiscerned by us, a directing mind, a governing spiritual principle. This everywhere present principle of life and the creative cosmic power are one and the same ear God. In both stars and men we see the sign or evidence of its incomparable intelligence and unbelievable omnipotence. Its laws are ever present, but human sense knows them only by the effects they produce in this world of form, time and space. If the universe were quite lawless, if universal events and movements, such as the sun's rising and the seed's growth, happened in a merely haphazard way, it could hardly go on with its existence. Even those microscopically tiny organisms we call cells, out of which plant, animal and human bodies are built up, contain latently and will develop eventually, the mentality and characteristics of man himself. And this they will do in conformity with the perfect pattern, by orderly stages and through millions of rebirths. Nothing that has happened in the world's history could ever have happened except by the ultimate sanction of the will and wisdom of the universal mind. Without this key to guide the reason, human thought would have to attribute what happens to mere chance. The universe would then seem senseless, fortune appear grossly unjust, and living itself mere folly. Life in every kingdom of nature would then indeed be the play of brute, mechanical, and blind forces, as the materialist thinks. But with this key we can discern amid all this chaotic turmoil, that there is a divine purpose behind human existence, a rational order within the universe itself and a beneficent mind as the real ruler of both. With it we can find some meaning in all existence and still more in human existence. This will no longer look like an insignificant speck of transient foam on the ocean but rather like the first faint glow of an eternal light. Let no one impugn the infinite wisdom of the universal mind merely because it is beyond his finite understanding or because evil and pain anger him. Could such a one have predicted, after seeing under a microscope and without prior knowledge, a minute piece of protoplasmic jelly, that it would grow into an adult man possessed of the capacity to think, to love and to worship? Yet every plant, every living animal shows forth the presence of cosmic intelligence in the progressive stages from seed to flower, from fetus to full-size creature. These stages are too wisely and obviously organized with and for the end in view to be the result of mere chance. The evolutionary process is as inevitable, however slow, as the sun's return. Nothing is, or is to be, left out, for every atom is alive and has the germ of self-consciousness. The old sharp division between dead inert matter and living active cells is out of date and dissolving in the new knowledge of electronics. There is no energy anywhere and no object which is not in essence a form under which the world mind's life current appears. The material of our fleshly robes was once mineral, later plant and animal, and is now human. Man's body is nature's crucible, his thought, her transmuting power. Unfoldment from the physical to the spiritual states necessitates passage through these three kingdoms, through different planets and through the human form, where the fires of self-consciousness lit in prior evolutions work their wondrous magic. Even more, just as the cells in his body are affected by what he does to and with it as well as by what he thinks mentally and feels emotionally, so man himself is affected by what the planet is doing to him. for it has its own individual goal towards which it is evolving, and because of which it slowly or abruptly changes the conditions for the living forms in all kingdoms dwelling on and in its body.